Translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. You may listen at KAXC.org or by asking your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much.
My mom is a visual artist, and she taught arts and crafts at a Bureau of Indian Affairs boarding school, of all things, which is a campus upon which I grew up. Complicated. She always encouraged us to be creative. My dad loved poetry and always encouraged us to recite poems. So those things made my notion that I'd have a creative life, you know, just basic to who I was.
Bonjour, hello, welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Leah Lem. Miigwech for joining me. Native Lights is more than a podcast and radio show. At its core, it's a place for Native folks to tell their stories. Every week, we have great conversations with wonderful guests from a bunch of different backgrounds, musicians, doctors, artists, educators, authors, you name it. We speak with a bunch of people with a wonderful mixture of passions. And we get to hear about their gifts and how they share those gifts with their community. And it all centers around the big point of purpose in our lives. And it's another day, another opportunity to amplify Native voices. And again, I'm solo hosting without my co-host and sibling, Mr. Cole Primo. He and his wife, Maria, are new parents, so he's taking some time off, which I'm super excited about. I will be glad when he's back, but for now, we'll let him spend some time snuggling with his new baby. But I am really excited to share my conversation with you today with Hyde E. Erdrich. Hyde is an author, researcher, educator, curator, and member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa. In 2024, she was the inaugural Minneapolis Poet Laureate, and in 2025, she served as the James Welch Distinguished Visiting Professor at the University of Montana, Missoula. Her recent books are Boundless, Abundance in Native American Art and Literature, which she co-edited, and Verb Animate, Poems, Prose, and Prompts from Collaborative Acts. So we get to hear more about her collaborative work and how she navigates her creative career. Please enjoy my conversation with Hyde E. Erdrich.
Good to see you.
All right. Bonjour, Hyde. Can you please introduce yourself and where you're joining from?
Bonjour. I'm Hyde Erdrich, a Majikwe Indigo. I am joining you from Minneapolis, Kekabikang.
Wonderful. And how are you and your family doing?
You know what? We're okay. Things are happening around the world, and most of them are worse than what we're getting through. So I'm just keeping it like glass half full.
Mm-hmm. So Hyde, is there anything you are thinking about these days that's kind of top of mind?
Well, of course, I'm thinking about how difficult the changes in American governance have been and will be for Indigenous people all over the world. So, I mean, I think I'm a very political person, so I'm preoccupied with the political. I'm impressed by the Miccosukee for fighting back against the concentration camp on their land. But I'm also at the same time always working out something else that's kind of, you know, more coming from my artistic center. And I have sort of two competing things right now. One is the research that I've done about family. You know, I always had abundant family stories, but I didn't really know sort of the paper trail or the facts around some of the things. My mom's family at Turtle Mountain enrollees, and we have tons on that. But some of the Métis people I got interested in learning more about Canada and the vast territories people crossed, you know, in the 1700s and through the 1800s. So like I've been sort of just thinking about my ancestors. And at the same time, I have been researching for a few years on one of my non-Indigenous ancestors who has this like a really long family background in the United States. So I was just learned a lot about that. And they came from Massachusetts originally when they first came from England to Massachusetts for the most part. So I've been doing a couple of little visits here and there in Massachusetts and looking at the places that they lived. So, yes, yeah, sort of a strange confluence of directions, north and from the east. And, I feel like, how did I get here in the middle?
Yeah, like you're this node that things are, that the histories come towards, and what are the probabilities of all that like coming to you?
Yeah, that's the huge thing. So this person got sick, and that person stopped going west with the Mormons. And, this other person was taken in by these native people at Mille Lacs, and therefore, a generation later, married my great grandmother. Just very just odd things. And my great grandmother wasn't from Mille Lacs, but that person had lived among native people, and I guess just decided that was his bag from then on.
What does that do to your perspective to current times?
You know what? That's the big artistic challenge, right? Is how do I bring that? I can't just be nostalgia or curiosity about the past. It has to be about how this is meaningful to me now. Of course, I've been thinking about migration and immigration a lot, so there's a lot of that. I've been thinking about why Americans stay in the country. Why stay? Native people, we stay because it's our land. I don't understand, and sometimes why it's so important to so many people who don't actually make a living off the land or have long histories of it. Why are you staying? I'm curious. So I'm starting to talk to people a little bit about, like, why did your family stay here? When did they come here? Why are they staying here?
Can you tell me a little bit more about the research? How are you researching this? Is it just like you go to the U of M or something and just like look at archives? But like, I'd imagine it's a little more than that.
Yeah, I've looked at archives. I was lucky enough to do an archival project with Amherst College, and they have a special collections in Native literature. And I was working on exhibition using visual art involving Indigenous peoples from New England and mostly around the Connecticut River and relationship to the Connecticut River. And then also the literature, which in that part of the country, the first literatures were heavily involved and even printed by Native people. So we have hundreds of years of literary history there, and I was able to look at those things and then do a bit of my own research on the side. So that's the ideal when you actually go in and you read old papers and you get to figure things out. So, like I said, I had that family, European immigrant family from way back who were living in New England, and they have records. And then I got to see those records in the Anishinaabemowin for the Anishinaabemowin speaking people who lived there, because they lived side by side for quite a long time and under the same laws. And Native people went to court, and those documents were written in Anishinaabemowin. And I got to see that sort of thing. And I'm not a speaker and I'm not fluent by any means, but I can read okay. It's a weird thing about me. Not good at speaking languages, but I can kind of get a sense of what's happening. And then comparing it, of course, to the English was really a fun project and proposition. A lot of those things are digitized too. So if you're really curious, you can go find them on the internet. And I wasn't able to do certain things during COVID, and for me, that really lasted into 2022. I was being really careful. I traveled some, but not easily. So I ended up also learning about digital collections all over the world and tried to read some in German, and just had a great experience finding out, like, how do you trail things down and how do you relate to a country your grandparents fled? What does that mean? Or a border crossed them, looking at things in French, even in ancient French. So, that was, I like the old documents, but then the other kind of research I do is more experiential, more personal.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and AMPRS with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today I'm chatting with Hyde E. Erdrich, author, researcher, educator, and curator, and member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa. So you're doing this research. Do you know kind of what you want it to become?
No. I've been doing it for
No.
almost 5 years, and I keep thinking, what is this? Is this a book of prose? I've thought of a few poems every now and then, and I've sketched a few poems out, but then they don't draw me back. And that's one of my clues to be like, maybe it's not a poem if it doesn't draw you back to do the kind of nitty-gritty crafting you have to do with a poem. I don't know quite yet. I was hoping to find out this summer.
Just like let it come to you. I know your bio is very extensive, so I could imagine that it could be one of many things, or if many of many things. But I also see, let me ask first, how would you describe your artistic career? Because I have this bio and I could, bullet point it, but how would you describe kind of your career arc?
Varied and eclectic and full of luck.
Yeah.
Buoyed by others. Others have been so kind to me, especially visual artists, and it has made, and my students. So it's never one thing. It's just a whole weaving of many, many things to no particular pattern.
I like it. Well, maybe let's go back in time then and see, how did you kind of get in the artist bug?
Oh, well, my mom is a visual artist and she taught arts and crafts at a Bureau of Indian Affairs boarding school of all things, which is a campus upon which I grew up. Complicated. She always encouraged us to be creative. My dad loved poetry and always encouraged us to recite poems. And so those things made my notion that I'd have a creative life, just basic to who I was. So we had skills. We all did art. We all did, whatever kind of intellectual pursuit we could get to. And sometime in high school, I really felt myself committing to that. I was going to be some kind of artist. But I always wanted to be a teacher too. Both my parents were teachers. And so I figured teaching would support my art some way, and it kind of did much of my life.
Do you see it as being kind of like, I know in talking to different artists, everybody's kind of different, but like a 9 to 5, sort of like, here's my professional life, or kind of just woven throughout?
Yeah, no, I'm not good with boundaries. I taught college, so my schedule had some open times in it, and I was able to travel, do other things, learn, research. It was really combined. And when you're teaching a craft, you really learn that craft. So teaching helped me so much, teaching and reading and having poetry ready for folks. And then when I started to look at visual art, and that came through my university teaching. I was asked to curate an exhibit, and then it became sort of a bug. I was like, I got to keep doing this. So yeah, they all kind of came organically from the same place, but I try not to think about balance because, it's like the caterpillar putting on its socks. That's what I've said. If it thought about it, it would fall over.
Oh, yeah, balance. What is that really? So I saw, in your bio, you have more and more collaborative work. Can you talk a bit about collaboration and what that means in your work?
It's really hard. In that new book I have, Verb Animate, there's an essay in the beginning about how I'm like, I still don't really know what collaboration is. It's like a relationship. It has so many different variations and patterns, and some people just communicate with one another and create from their conversation, and some you literally are hands-on making something with someone else. And that was really an antidote to feeling like, oh, my thoughts are my own and it's just not that important given a whole community's thoughts. And how do I connect to and work from a place where it's not just me thinking about myself alone? It's one of the things I don't enjoy about all poetry. I just didn't want to be just thinking about myself. So working with others really helped expand how I was thinking.
Do you have pointers on how to best collaborate with people?
Yeah, I mean, don't have a ton of expectations to begin with, or at least state your expectations, because sometimes things start happening. There's kind of a magic of it where you are getting grooving on something and somebody is like, no, I want to do this extra bit more. And somebody else might be like, that's all I'm doing for now. It's just not going away. That's continues to be satisfying. This is my contribution. I want to move on. So you just don't expect everybody to just divvy it up and pitch in. And also just don't stop yourself from the coincidences, synchronicities, jives, vibes that happen. Just let them happen and figure out what it is later. I think that's what I would say. But then at the same time, I would say have somebody who's organized as part of the project.
Dang. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, thanks for that. How would you describe a day in your life as a creative or a week in your life? Is there anything that looks like regular?
No, no, I'm so. I mean, somebody watching me would notice my bad habits are regular. But there's a lot of just staring into space or looking at stuff, watching videos. There's just like, I think I function a little bit more the way a visual artist does. Like, I need a lot of visual input. I read a lot, but sometimes in big bursts, I'll read a huge stack of books of poems, new books, or whatever. And then when I'm looking for my own thing, I don't really look at others' poetry because I need to catch my own thing. It might look like a lot of domestic projects. I really love having a home and taking care of it after all these years. I couldn't really do it when I was working too much. So yeah, it might look like that. It might look like, staring at the lake, at the big lake, which is one of the best places for me to see what I'm doing, just looking out at the big lake, conversations. But I do have this space that I come to every day. I don't always sit down and write in it, but it's my spot. Yeah, so I mean, sometimes I'm writing a poem into a text to myself, then I can never find it again, but
You mentioned bad habits.
oh yeah.
Do you have a best bad habit?
Oh, Oh my gosh. Well, I drink coffee and I believe coffee is good for us. I mean, it's like they would never give me ADHD medicine, so the coffee is it for me, and I feel strongly about the importance of the Mukde Mashkiki Wabu, and especially the Mashkiki part of it. A little tea, although I drink it without Kiki sometimes too. Yeah, guess
Yeah.
that's one of them. A best worst habit is probably just letting myself just not talk to people sometimes. Like, sorry, I'm not gonna pick up this phone call. I'm not gonna be on time for the Zoom until I finish a thought, because my thoughts can, oh, they take a long time sometimes. So,
That's a good lesson too, I think, because the time and the talking in modern society, right? We're all so accessible to one another that it's a little unnatural to be so connected and so available and accessible that maybe there is, something to be said, less bad. Maybe best bad habit, just being a little less accessible, especially right at a certain time.
I appreciate that. Actually, whenever anybody can tell an artist that it's fine for them to be alone, it's a huge gift to them.
Yeah, and you mentioned synchronicities before, in the collaboration process. Do you have like a recollection of a favorite synchronicity that happened or a favorite like coming together of minds?
Oh, I feel like I've told this one before, but it is my favorite. It's the artist Andrea Carlson, Grand Portage Descendant. Yeah, just a wonderful friend of mine. One time I was reading poems to try and help me remember something, and I was reading a particular poem, and Andrea texted me and said, "What you doing?" And I said, "Oh, I'm reading this poem about the pink dolphins." And while I was going to get the link to send it to her, she sent me a picture of a painting of a pink dolphin that she was working on. And I was like, yes, that's the vibe. That's why we can work together. And like, what an obscure freaking thing for us to be both about river dolphins and, on another continent. So things like that happen, but they're so constant. They're so thick with certain people I work with that it's just, they don't stand out. They're just the texture of the thing. Like Elizabeth Day, who I hope to get to work with again, filmmaker Elizabeth Day. And when I'm like doing, I did crowdsourcing, Poet Laureate, I did these crowdsourced poems where I just, ask people to come to me in public events and answer some questions. And then I read back their lines with combined with my lines, which were set. And it was just, sometimes it was just so perfect. It all just worked together so well. And it really sounded poetic. And, we all got chills and stuff. And so sometimes it's not just because somebody, you've been working with them. It could be the feeling in the air.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today I'm chatting with Hyde E. Erdrich, author, researcher, educator, and curator, and member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa. So when you work on poetry, do you have, or writing, do you have a work style? Like, do you do all your research first and then do your work, or do you like doodle, or how do you even start?
Usually I just sit down at my computer and start. And when I have a big project in mind, the titles come first and I'll put them into different files. And I go back in and work on them. Last year, I broke both elbows and a wrist and sprained the other one. So I wasn't able to work the way I wanted to, but to teach my body and my brain to coordinate my wrists and hands and elbows after they'd been broken. You have this like weird thing that they don't want to, like this one was hurt so bad that if I went to pick something up, it would go, no, thank you. And then, so I had to write by hand. And so lately I've been writing by hand and it's a whole experience that I haven't engaged for a really long time. So that's been wonderful. But yeah, so like physically, I look at things, I keep things around me to remember ideas that I just sort of, like pick them up and imbue them with an idea. I have like, there's this little button that happens to say Anin on it. I'm just like, oh, keep this idea in here and put it down and then like pick it up and hope it's still in there. I mean, I have some odd things that I do. I have 1,000 tabs open, on my desktop. And then I go back in there and try to remember what it was I was thinking about. 1,000 screenshots on my phone. So sometimes I have a little trigger like that that I've saved for myself.
Yeah, back to injury. Just as a note, we had a beader on, a person who did beadwork who had an injury to her wrist, I believe, who was beading as a part of, getting back to healing. Do you find that like writing helped heal?
Yeah, it really helped because at first I decided to write on my students' papers. I went out to Montana to teach for 5 months and I was like, how am I going to do this? I've been typing and it was just so painful with my, few little fingers in a cast and, everything else. So I started writing by hand and it really helped and really worked. So physically, just to reconnect my brain. And then eventually the pain really reduced too. If I didn't write for a weekend, my hands would be all stiff and sore. So yeah, so I'm kind of keeping that with me as a, practice to just try to do more of that.
Do you feel like there's a different connection to your writing? Like your brain writing connection when you handwrite versus type?
Yeah, there's a little bit more of a flow to it. I tend not to think about the page as much, how something's going to look on the page when I'm handwriting it. My handwriting is not great, and I move pretty quickly when I'm writing longhand. So sometimes I don't remember what I wrote and I have to go back to it. And then it's a challenge to like earn the wording back. It's a craft challenge and I really appreciate it. I do think it's a little different. You know, I don't keep drafts of my electronic files. Like, I don't have like version one, version two, version three, or rarely do. Like, occasionally I'll keep one draft, whatever is lost. But in handwriting, it's not lost. So you have multiple versions of it if you don't toss it. That will be interesting this year to look back at some of these handwritten things after I've typed them up and the deep edit stage.
Got it. Well, Hyde, I think I'm going to ask a tough one here. Speaking of versions, how do you know when a piece is done?
When it's due.
When it's due. I love it. Just have a due date and just
That's it.
ship it.
I occasionally have written something where I just ripped it off and I'm like, you know what? I am not going back in this one again. I feel really good about where it is. And unless somebody forces me to, I'm not gonna. So who asks for a poem for publication? You get this one and I don't want to look back.
I know some poets that they go up to read their fully published book and they're like, I'm going to change his word.
I'm one of those. It's very sad. The poem that I turned in last night for a publication, I put draft next to it. I mean, it's going to be produced in a publication form for student writers or younger writers, so I was fine with that. But I just put draft behind the title because I'm like, they may never see another, this version again, or it could be completely different because it was so new. I'd only been working on it a couple months, so.
Great. Well, what other ways do you express yourself, Hyde?
Sing with a lady's hand drum, and most of us are writers, so that's kind of fun that we've all been friends over the years because we're writers, and then we formed this group through another writer friend. So, I mean, I used to cook a lot. I don't cook as much as I did. I garden. I guess those are the things that don't necessarily show up in my vitae.
Wonderful. Well, as kind of a final question, what would you recommend to up-and-coming writers, just who want to have a lasting career in the creative arts?
It's really important to meet other writers and to spend time with them and get to know what projects they're working on that are collaborative, editing, literacy projects. It's hard because you don't necessarily think of yourself as a social person when you're a person who does creative work because you need so much time alone. But at the same time, you really do need to establish those relationships. And having a book group is great. Having a writing group is great. Those things all will expand your work.
That was Hyde E. Erdrich chatting with me about many things, including her collaborative process and the importance of time alone. Thank you so much, Hyde, fellow coffee drinker, for letting us get a glimpse into your life and creativity. I'm Leah Lem. Miigwech for listening. Gigawabamin. You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and AMPRS, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Green Cheese listeners know how important it is to support stations like KAXE KBXE.
Anyone who can, be sure to donate, because as all of us know, we listen to this Green Cheese and all the other programming on the stations. We really, really love it and don't want anything to happen to it. So it's really important to give what you can.
One thing I wanted to do is I wanted to talk to everybody out there. Radio is important when it's unique and it's interesting and it's local. And given your current funding situation, everybody out there should be doing something about that, no matter how little it is. If everybody did something, it makes a tremendous difference. Think about Saturday nights with no green cheese. That sounds terrible.
It would be so boring.
This is the queen, and I'm going to make an edict. All cheeses, get your checkbooks out and send in some money to our favorite station and show, and my check will be in the mail tomorrow.
Donate now at KAXE.org.
Thanks for tuning in to KAXE Rewind. I'm Heidi Holton. Hope you're having a good weekend as we celebrate Grand Rapids River Fest. Coming up in this half hour, a conversation from our arts reporter, Andrew DeZingle, his weekly Area Voices conversation, this time with Steve Call. He's the son of the prolific artist Marley Call, and there is a retrospective of his work over his life at the Tally Gallery in Bemidji. It's on display until the end of October. We'll hear that conversation with Steve Call coming up next. But first, some music now from this year's Riverfest performer, Margot Price.
Teacher, I'm a sinner, I'm a preacher, and I know that there's more here than this, so I stand in the mind of the black magic.
Time now for Area Voices, our look at local arts happenings in our area. And there is a new exhibit at the Tally Gallery on BSU campus, Marley Call Retrospective, featuring the works of artist Marley Call. It opens tomorrow with an opening reception the same day from 4 to 7 p.m. Here to talk more about the exhibit and a new book featuring Marley Call's work is Steve Call. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thanks so much, Andrew.
So, first off, Marley Call is a very well-respected artist from Minnesota, but for people who may not be familiar, how would you describe Marley's style of painting?
Well, Marley developed a style over a number of years, and he uses color really effectively. I think that's one of his main attributes. He's just mastery of color. And I guess I would describe them as abstracts, but they vary. Some are more abstract than others. And over the decades, they evolved and figures would emerge. And I think his later works are actually quite symmetrical and iconic. They deal with objects placed in a space and deal with motion and all sorts of things. So more recognizable figures in the later work, I would say.
And yeah, so what will be featured at the exhibit at the Tally Gallery?
The Tally Gallery opening tomorrow night is probably the first chance that anyone would have to see his work from each decade of his life. We just finished a book that covers his lifetime of painting, and this exhibit is a very good companion piece for that. It starts with works that he did in the 1960s when he was teaching at BSU. Then it moves into the 70s with some pretty interesting pieces. Some of them are three-dimensional that I don't think people would have ever seen before. Then in the 80s, he worked on smaller pieces of paper with gouache on paper. We've got a nice selection of those from the late 70s and 80s. Then in the 90s, he was working on very big canvases. So there's really, it runs the gamut. You'll see incredible works that I hadn't seen some of these before, and I grew up with them. So I can guarantee that there are works that people have not seen.
That's great. And how were the paintings selected for the book? Was that a difficult process to choose what made the book?
It was, partly due to the fact that Marley created over 500 works in his lifetime. Many of them had been sold or were in people's homes and displayed at, you know, banks and hospitals and museums and galleries and other places. So we really had to rely on slides. Luckily for us, Marley, when he was still alive, began this book, and he began the process of going through all of his slides with his book designer, Lynn. And they would select, oh, what's the best image of this work? And what can we fix here? And he had gone through and selected many of the images that he liked. And then when he passed in 2021, we carried on with that process, and we discovered works that we had at the studio that weren't in frames, but were absolutely beautiful. Mm-hmm. So we began photographing those. And then people started letting us know about other works, and we discovered things as we went along. It was quite a long process, and we ended up having to take another year with the book just because of all the work we found, and that we wanted to present it as best we could.
Oh, that kind of sounds like a treasure hunt, too.
It was. It was really heartening for Sandy Call, Marley's partner in life and artistic foil, and she was really our guiding light through the whole process. She had been around for the creation of all these artworks, and my sister Allison Call De Leon. The three of us banded together, and it took all three of us to sort through it all.
Uh-huh. So for these pieces that even you hadn't seen before, was it kind of like, did you make a call out to people that maybe had some pieces that weren't regularly available, or how did you find these never before seen pieces?
Well, many of them were in the studio, and we just didn't know they were there. So as we went through the process, we would open up a folder drawer, and we would find drawings from the 60s, some of which are featured in the book. From the time he was in college, but you can see his style going through. So we discovered those, and then there were rolls of canvases that we didn't know what was in there. As we unrolled them, we realized that they were very powerful, colorful paintings from, you know, other decades that we just were knocked out by. So we decided to photograph them, and then we looked at each other and thought, you know, if we were really nuts, we would try to stretch these on stretcher bars and put a show together. And it turns out that our wonderful friends, Alice Blessing at the Tally Gallery, who's the director there, and Mitch Blessing helped us to get some of those paintings stretched. And so we did that all just for this Tally Gallery show.
Yeah, why did it seem like such a good fit to have this show in sort of celebration of the new book coming out? Why did it seem special to have this at BSU?
Well, Marley taught at BSU for 34 years. He was a distinguished professor there and had many, many students who went on to do great things. David Bartley, who is at the Walker now down in Minneapolis, an avid painter. Tom Paquette, who you may know, is a very well-established and wonderful artist. Doug Argue was also a student for a time at BSU, who has gone on to great things. And so it was important that the exhibit was at BSU. It's a really strong connection there to the art department. And things have changed a lot, but they're starting to come back around. And I think this show is going to help to kick some things off. And I should mention too that during the time that Dad was teaching at BSU, Sandy, his wife, was the gallery director at the original Tally Gallery. So it's a bit of a homecoming in that way.
So yeah, the opening reception will be going on tomorrow from 4 to 7 p.m. And it's free for the public to attend. So welcome everyone to come and join. So for people who are interested, and the new book is called Paintings, where can people find the book at?
Well, we are releasing that on October 1st. So it's available for pre-sale now through Itasca Books, or I think even, you know, the normal online retailers that we all know and sometimes have to use anyhow, I won't name names. But we will be having some book launch events. The first one down in the cities on the 18th at Open Book in the Loft Literary Center, for those who are in this area. Then the second one will be on Tuesday, September 23rd at the Watermark Art Gallery. And that will be our first Bemidji event where the book will be available.
Nice.
Excellent. So I had a chance to get a sneak preview of the exhibit yesterday. And I think something that makes it really interesting is that, like you said, it spans the entire career. And rarely do you get to see an artist's progression in one exhibit from the 60s to 2020. And so maybe can you talk a little bit about that, of kind of the what were changes you noticed throughout Marley's artistic career?
That's a really interesting point. So part of the reason that Marley wanted to create this fourth book was to look back at his lifetime of work and notice these kinds of things. Similarities between styles or developments of styles. And so we thought the same thing. As we look back at the artwork, we thought, well, we can do this chronologically, but separating it just arbitrarily into decades doesn't make sense. He worked in series. So you'll see a series of works from the 60s. Then you'll see a series of work in the 70s when he was in California painting. the sense of place. You could really see that. And then when he came back in the 80s, there was a whole other tableau, and you had subject matter from the Bemidji area. And some of the names came from areas around here. So you could see where he was living at the time. For instance, a trip to Norway inspired some very colorful yellow churches with bright blue skies and vertical kind of Norwegian sort of topography. So we noticed that. We noticed that where he was living in the landscape really influenced his art. And then we also noticed that the way he used color developed, and he became more bold as he went on, oftentimes putting real contrary-looking colors together just to make things pop. And he really became a master of that. I think in his later works, the smaller egg tempera works, you can see really fine lines of a bright green next to a bright orange. And you don't notice it until you get real close, but from a distance, it just makes that edge really effective. We noticed, so the use of color developed. Then we also noticed his sense of motion is something that carried through all of his works. For some reason, he knew how to lead the eye around and create this sense of flow, almost like water flowing through, you know, a river or a current. And that was something else that we picked out as time went on. What Alice Blessing noticed when she looked at the sneak peek of the book was that he was very experimental. He really pushed boundaries, and he didn't stick with one style his whole life. He really pushed himself to go beyond. And that's why I think you see so many different kinds of work in this book and in the exhibit at the Tally.
Excellent. So the exhibit will be opening tomorrow with the opening reception from 4 to 7. Will you be joining for the opening reception tomorrow?
Yes, I will be there. My sister Allison will be there. Sandy will be there, and as well as Mitch and Alice, I imagine. And a whole lot of Bemidji folks, we hope, and from the whole area. And we really appreciate you helping us get the word out about it, because there were a lot of people who know Marley's work out there, but they just haven't seen some of these things. And we think they'd be really happy to see them.
Yeah, absolutely. Can highly recommend checking them out. What I really enjoyed seeing tomorrow was especially the pieces from the 60s were kind of smaller pieces, and watching as his career progressed, the paintings would get larger and larger. And it's an interesting thing to see happen in like an order way.
yeah, it's pretty remarkable. At one point he really liked to work big, and you notice that energetic brush stroke just gives a sense of either flying or wind or something. But yeah, I remember watching him paint on those canvases, and his arm was going pretty well. He was a baseball player when he was in high school and college, so he had a pretty good arm.
Yeah, perfect. All right, well, Steve, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
All right. Thank you so much also. Take care.
You too. Area Voices is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota. Now's your chance to see one of the most acclaimed indie rock artists of the past 20 years at Grand Rapids Urfest, going on Saturday, September 6th. In addition to Courtney Barnett, you'll get to see Alan Sparhawk, Jeremy Albino, and Margo Price. Don't let the bastards get you down. Don't sell your heart to no businessman. Just sell it back next time around. Don't let the bastards get you down. You can get your tickets for Grand Rapids Riverfest at GrandRapidsRiverfest.com. You won't want to miss one of the biggest concert nights in northern Minnesota this year.
You're listening to KAXC Rewind. It's here on People Powered Radio for northern Minnesota. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you so much for tuning in this weekend. And thank you for supporting KAXC, especially as we have been facing the cut of all funding from the federal government, the closing of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You came through in spades. You helped us out. We raised over $162,000. Each year will be $200,000 less than we had been promised from the federal government. We're working hard to use these funds to continue to bring you great radio that makes you feel something, that makes you feel connected. If you didn't get a chance to donate, you can do that by texting the word donate to 218-326-1234. Attend our events like Grand Rapids River Fest. Tell other people about KEXE. Our question of the week has been about Grand Rapids River Fest, about your experiences, maybe someone you ran into, your best concert, your best performer there, or other live concerts that you might have gone to because you heard those artists first on KAXE. We heard from some of you, including Siri, who weighed in on last year's River Fest. She's looking back on it fondly because now is an empty nester. Her two kids were with her and a former student of hers, and they had a lot of fun. And we'd love to hear from you. Tell us your story of live music, KAXE. You can text 218-326-1234. Right now, we're going to listen to some nature notes. It's from our Tuesday morning program, Phenology. And each week, we get a chance to hear from area students. This time, it is from John Latimer, a walk he gave at the Sugar Lake Lodge in Grand Rapids and the kids he met there.
Okay, so my name is Julia, and I'm from Eden Prairie, and something I found cool today is that a different type of a tree is a spruce or balsam, and how you can tell the difference is because the spruce, the little pines will roll, and the balsam, it won't, will be the flat, and a balsam also smells like Christmas, kind of.
My name is Nora. I live in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, and I loved catching the frogs, and I think it was really cool that we got to learn what poison ivy looks like.
My name is Jayla. I'm from Eden Prairie. The jewel seeds, you can touch the bottom of them and they'll explode. And the poison ivies aren't the same kind of teeth on both of the sides.
A couple days ago, I found a bone that was from some type of bird. And I found a rock that's 3.5 billion years old. I found 3 golf balls and I caught 4 frogs.
I am Jameson. I learned that I live in Plymouth. I learned there are spiders in the water.
My name is Nina and I found a seashell in the water.
Hi, my name is Elliot, and I live in Minnesota Maple Grove. I found a snake skin on the hike. Mr. John told me it was a female because it was like 3 feet long, and that the male and the females are bigger.
Hi, my name is Adeline, and I live in Big Lake, Minnesota. Today, I caught a dragonfly on our nature hike, and I learned that if they're white-faced dragonflies, then they can bite. But if they're not white-faced, that means they don't bite. And I learned that the gold dragonflies, in some species, dragonflies have to be golden, and the boys are usually red or blue.
I'm Maddie from Minneapolis, and this is what we did on our nature hike. First, we went to the lake, and we caught a bunch of frogs. We caught a green frog, a leopard frog, a grasshopper, and butterflies. A goat to nature.
Sam from Edina here at Sugar Lake Lodge. We went to, like, ponds, locations of bodies of water. We also got to look at butterflies, grasshoppers. It was an amazing old time. And it's really just like, nature's awesome, man. Like, if you're one of those kids who are just reading books about stuff, don't just read those books. Go out there and find those creatures.
That is great advice coming from our phenology students observing nature. What have you been seeing out there as we get into fall? We're going to be seeing some of our last things like our last loons on the lake. Are you hearing owls, eagles? You can text us your nature notes, 218-326-1234. On behalf of all of the staff and board, volunteers, and members of KEXE, thank you for being a part of it, and thank you for tuning in. Support for KEXE comes from the 17th Annual Community Connect, Thursday, September 18th, from 11 to 3 at Yanmar Arena in Grand Rapids. Over 50 social service agencies providing information on housing, energy, county assistance, and more. All are welcome. More info can be found by dialing 211. This has been KEXE Rewind. Here's Alan Sparhawk from his new release, a collaboration with Trampled by Turtles.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. This Monday, it's another installment of What We're Reading. Staff librarian Tammy Bobrowski talks with Minnesota writer Todd.